You're listening to the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. All right, this week, we're going behind the scenes of It's Alive, one of our oldest and most popular video series starring Brad Leone. Brad is joined in studio by Matt Hunziker, who edits the videos. If you've ever watched It's Alive, all those funny little pop-ups and sound effects and everything that makes It's Alive so It's Alive, that is Hunzi's doing. During the interview, there's a lot of references to Vince or Vinny. That would be Vincent Cross, the original pioneer of It's Alive, cameraman, Brad's partner. And so Vinny gets lots of love on this one, as he should. If you haven't watched It's Alive, I highly recommend that you check it out. Just go to our YouTube channel, Bon Appetit YouTube, and there's like, 55 of them, I want to say. It's been going for 3 years now, and it's wonderful and weird and wacky and awesome. After that, we are taking a dive into reader mail. New segment this week. We've got on Carla Lolly Music and my assistant Ryan Walker, who is Ryan's on the receiving end of a lot of that mail, often in the handwritten or typewritten form of people sending us stuff. Sometimes it's complimentary, sometimes less so. There are a couple of topics we've been getting a lot of mail about recently, both related to Carla Music, so we put her on the hot seat. And then we have a new installment on the pod, Cook, Marry, Kill, in which senior staff writer Alex Beggs tells you one thing she cooked in the past week, one thing she wants to marry, and one new food thing she wants to kill, figuratively. It's short, it's sweet, it's semi-based on her hilarious and highly recommended weekly newsletter, which you can sign up for. Oh, look at this, at bonappetit.com/newsletter/subscribe, and you'll get newsletters from not only Beggs, but you'll get a weekly one from me and a weekly one from Carla Music. Also, let us know what you think about the pod. Give us some suggestions. What do you want to hear? You can reach us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. All right, let's do this. How have we never done an It's Alive podcast before?
I think because you maybe never seen it before.
The show. I've heard a lot about it. People talk about it on Slack and everything.
You were watching it when we came in here. That's kind of a last minute cramming session.
It's like when my 11-year-old son is doing like homework at the breakfast table at 7:13 a.m. before we had to be out the door at 7:15 a.m. Marwan, I thought you said you didn't have homework last night. You know.
Like, okay. Well, the old apple doesn't fall too far.
He watches it, though.
That's what I think, as you know, because you guys make the show, how many kids watch the show?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I meet so many friends my age, like, oh, my God, my kids love your YouTube channel. I'm like, well, what about you guys? Like, I don't know. My kids love it.
Yeah. I think a lot of that is because of the platform of being on YouTube. So, like, my parents don't watch YouTube. You know, they know the show because I'm their son. But, like, if that wasn't the case, they would have never heard of it unless like someone else's kid in the family told them about it or something. You know what I mean? Like they don't watch YouTube.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of people in that, you know, anywhere from, I mean, people send me pictures of like young kids watching it.
Well, there is something. So I literally was just now going back to like episode one and now we're on episode 55. One launched almost exactly 3 years ago.
Right.
October 2016. And it's kind of fascinating how much the show hasn't changed, and I guess, or in the sense that how well fermented it was in the very first episode. And like, talk to me about that, because the editing, the pop-ups, the science, like all those little burp, like the funny sounds, like wow, that was all in there in the first episode.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it came out of necessity by the way that we were shooting, that we had shot that video, it was kind of all over the place. And so when we watched it back, we felt like it needed to be supplemented with something. And so we did these like informational pop-ups, and then I'm a comedian, so I want to do funny things.
Literally.
You're
not like, that's not like a figure of speech.
No, yeah, I'm go perform comedy to people. But yeah, so I did some like weird graphics, and Vince, who was the person who shot it,
aka Vinny,
aka yeah. Vinny, we just kind of started messing around, and we assumed someone would stop us.
Yeah,
what happened is I
someone from like the FDA, you mean?
Well, just like someone like
No,
just like I zoomed in on his hand hitting like a pepper that he never acknowledged, and like
it was a very different format style of video. I mean,
yeah,
well, A to Z.
You talk about all the pop ups and the informationals and the sound effects as a technique to sort of bind the video together. The first episode was about 10 minutes long. How many hours of footage did you have that you had to whittle down to get to that 10 minutes?
That one is interesting because there's about 10 hours of footage.
Wow.
We got more efficient as we went on. That one, part of the reason that it's kind of a very loose, almost like documentary style with Brad is because for that particular shoot, Vince had also had to get Brad out of the office so that people could plan a surprise birthday or a baby shower him. Oh, and so he went and filmed him at like the farmer's market and Whole Foods. And so it was just Vinny following Brad around with a camera. Like half of it was filming the episode. Half of it was to get him out of the kitchen so that everybody could come surprise him.
A bad example, Kombucha.
Yeah.
Past that. We've gotten better at just... You know, it was always just me and Vinny. Like, we'd go to Alaska or go make something in the test kitchen or whatever, and then we'd just hand off all this footage.
Right.
Yeah, I was just saying, if we can rewind a bit for the listeners who don't know Brad's total background, but I think the challenge with that one was like, hey, there was a feeling in the office that, hey, we should do a show with Brad. We don't know what that show is going to be, but we love Brad. Brad is so Brad, and at the time you were the test kitchen manager, which meant you were a guy that ordered the groceries, going way back, even did the dishes.
Oh yeah,
back in the day at Four Times Square. So the notion of you being like a on-camera YouTube star was not obvious.
No, I mean, it wasn't even a thing when we started. I'll tell you the story. So, you know, when I started at Bon Appetit, I did an internship, and back when Condé Nast did internships.
Yeah,
and then eventually they offered me a job as a test kitchen assistant. So I would come in and I would help out with the groceries, anything they wanted me to do. I'd give me a job anywhere. My mind was just get my foot in and I'll try to work my way up into something. You know?
Is it true you'd been in the Navy?
I had a short stint in the Navy. That's going to have to be a different podcast.
How did that end?
Well, it depends who you ask. I wouldn't be talking to you right now if... I didn't get kicked out.
Okay, there you go. All right, so fast forward, Condé Nast, internship turns into an assistant job.
And then it turned into being a test kitchen manager. And what I'm getting at is that during that internship in the beginning days of test kitchen manager, there wasn't, Bon Appetit, we didn't really shoot video. And the video that we did shoot was certainly not personality driven. It was very over, and this is what everyone was doing, very, unless it was TV, it was very overhead, hands and pans.
Never liked those.
They were the worst. I hated them. So that's kind of how the birth of It's Alive happened. Back in the day, remember the lovely Alex Grossman? He made a bunch of us do some like media training. We went up to this lady on the Upper West Side, and she like, I think she used to be like a news anchor or something. And she was like trying to teach us how
Her name was Diane Sawyer.
Oh my God, no.
And what? No, I'm joking.
And, you know, she was just trying to teach us how to be comfortable in front of camera, yada, yada, as we had this idea of starting to do more forward, looking at the person talking, unscripted, semi-scripted kind of shows. That's what they were trying to get into. And I remember then after we did our training, we all did like little test videos. And I forget what recipe I did or something, but I made one and talked through it. And I remember Grossman being like, I don't know what the hell that is. But it's not Brad, and that's not it. That's not what we're trying to do. So, I mean, huge tip of the hat there for catching that. And then eventually what it ended up happening was I always just had, you know, being test kitchen manager, I had, you know, when there was downtime or whatever, I would do little projects. And I started to ferment, and I started to – just on my own time. And, you know, just as, like, that communal bond, that family that is now the test kitchen. Like
what's the saying, don't ask for permission, ask for forgiveness?
Yeah. Easier to ask for forgiveness than it is permission.
Yeah, there were literally things that, like, were just bubbling and simmering in these weird containers. Life. And you're like, where did that come from? And people would be like, oh, I don't know. Someone's on top of it.
It's going to be fine. And and I started making kombucha for everyone. And then I remember Vince and you weren't even here at the time.
I wasn't. So it was shot in, I think, like March or April of 2016.
So they were just like, Vince, just go. People like hanging out with Brad. He's always doing nutty stuff down there. He's fun. Just like get the camera and just follow him around. Just follow him, do something. And like that's how the first episode was kombucha. And I hated it at first. And it sat on a hard drive for like 8 months. It almost never, Vince had to like just take a risk. Let's try something a little different. Let's just put it out. What's the worst that can happen? Mm-hmm. And
then when I got there in like late August, early September of 2016, Vince had this rough cut that he had done of kombucha that was like, hey, I got this thing. Can you do like, you know, graphics? And I kind of had this idea. And so I took a look at it and we sat down and started brainstorming like how to make this have some kind of flow and humor element to it.
So when you say rough, like how long was it at that point?
I think it was like 12 minutes.
Oh, so
like
it had gotten that tight.
So he had chopped it down to a reasonable amount, and then we brought it down a few minutes more.
So, Brad, I guess one thing that is, I think, so endearing about the show that now fans take to, and it's like, oh, it's very funny. They're kind of making fun of Brad the way he talks, or maybe he gets stuff wrong now and then. What was your initial reaction to that?
I didn't like it at first. I thought I was too goofy. I didn't like how they were poking fun at me in a way. It's just not the vibe that I envisioned making a food kind of video. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, we kind of addressed that, and I think it changed and we evolved. And I, you know, as I grew with the show, I think everything kind of did. And yeah, I mean, it took a little while to warm up to it, but then it was. Then I think we found a groove, and it just kind of, and it made sense.
Well, what tipped the scales for you? What made you think like, oh, actually, I kind of see what Hunzi and the guys are. I get where this thing is going.
Well, because I liked how it was a different. I liked how it was a different style of video. Mm-hmm. I liked how we did bring information, but also laughs. I liked how it was kind of, you know, personality driven and a little like I make mistakes. We roll with it. It's not just a clean. There's no food stylist, and there was no Rhoda Boone, you know, sliding in the pretty to finish up the video, which back in the day, that's how everything was. It was swaps, and I'm like, that's not cooking. People are going to, I mean, not that everything I do is cooking either, but, you know, when whether it's making a pasta dish or sauerkraut or, you know, people are going to watch these super clean, edited, no mistake videos, get their recipe, go home, try it out, and have very different experiences. So I always wanted to make videos where we can roll with that human element that is involved in cooking with the mistakes and that approachability. And it was kind of that with the graphics and the fun and the, you know, I like yapping and talking and having fun too. And it kind of just became this little perfect storm of video.
Yeah. And it certainly is tough from the point of view of somebody who's having their face put out there to be portrayed in a way that doesn't make them necessarily seem fully competent at what they're doing. But I think at its core, it was like, this is a man who's skilled at this, is competent, and has the talent, but is still making mistakes, because that happens when anyone's in the kitchen. And so we're used to, you know, everything goes perfectly well and there's no mistakes and anything, but you look at the test kitchen any day of the week and everybody's making mistakes, everybody's adjusting. And so it was embracing that element, that it's not so much we're laughing at him, it's that we're kind of going through that process of like, oh, stuff happens and we got to adjust, and it's kind of funny sometimes.
Yeah, I think as an editor, we always talk about things like voice or sense of humor. Right. And as an editor, it's hard to put your finger on why something has the BA voice and why it doesn't. But I think watching the show just from the first episode was that, yes, Hunzi and the editors are having fun with Brad, but I never felt like they were making fun of you. It was always like, it's funny, it's relatable, it is like something that any of us are in the kitchen, we struggle, we're challenged. None of us understand the science of something.
Right.
And you made it okay for us to be like, yeah, you know what? I don't really know what I'm doing either.
And let's have fun with it.
And it makes it approachable to learn that if you aren't an expert, if you don't have experience with it, that it's...
100%. Yeah. I've gotten so much feedback from folks like, thank you, Brad. Like, your approach to food got me back interested in fermentation or cooking for that matter. Or, you know, I think it's just a fun format way to learn while also being extremely entertained, hopefully.
Do we... Where'd the theme music come from? Do we pay for that every time we use it? How does that work?
We have a subscription to this wonderful, weird website called Jingle Punks that has like royalty-free music. And so Vince and I sat down and kind of went through and figured out like what's the vibe of this show and what's like a silly but fun, like try to, I mean, the whole show is trying to match Brad's personality or at least supplement it in some way.
And then what about like the little, like if there's pop-up visuals or are there certain things we need rights for, or how does that work?
Yeah, I mean, that's an ongoing process in terms of like what media libraries we're using, but there's subscriptions to like a Shutterstock or a Getty Images or different motion graphics templates and stuff. At the beginning, we were just using whatever the like public domain, like we didn't have resources for it, so we were using like Jingle Punks has some sound effects but not a ton, so we're like limited to that. So it was like a fun creative process to like work around having limited resources, and that's I think why the style of some of the graphics, especially early on, is like kind of intentionally pretty bad. Like the clip art is like low resolution, or it's whatever we could get our hands on without like violating copyright. Right. Before anybody was willing to, you know, to pay for a media library to...
Right.
What was your first inkling, either of you, where you're like, oh, this is going to be like, this is actually a thing?
Well, I mean, at first we were just chasing after it was all about Facebook. We were YouTube. We didn't get any, I mean, we got 10,000, 20,000 YouTube views, and it was all about getting Facebook numbers. And then all of a sudden, like, YouTube really started to take off, and like, no one even cared about Facebook anymore. So I think when YouTube started to take off.
But I mean, like, you personally, was there some moment where like someone came up to you at Wegmans or something, or you know what I mean? Like, when there was like a thing where you're like, oh, yeah.
I mean, for me, I guess it kind of happened gradually. And like, you know, it was like every now and then someone would like say hi, or like Instagram, or like you would get, and now it's just kind of, I don't know, it just happens often. It's great. And I think it's because like when people watch it, and like the way I talk to the camera, whether it was Vinny or Matt now, I feel like people think, I feel like that's them, you know, like we're buddies. So I think there's a nice approachability to it.
Hans, from when did you think it was like, oh, this actually has the potential to have legs and become?
Like Brad said, it felt more gradual than I think in like long-term mm-hmm. scale that it was. I think the fifth episode was when I felt like, oh, we're getting away with this. Like, I kind of went ham with the graphics and sound effects and assumed that somebody would be like, all right, that's fun, but like, you know, this doesn't go with the brand, or we have a different vision for how we see video working. And that went out there, and that one got pretty positive responses. And after that, we kind of got the green light to keep making it, which was, that was huge. And then I think when I saw like people that I knew like from high school or college or ever post about it, but like I hadn't sent it to them, is when I realized like, oh, this is something that's out there in the world.
It seems like there's almost unanimous support for the series. Has there been any negative comments that you have sort of been like, oh, like, okay, that's actually a good point, like maybe we should do less of this or more of that?
I mean, yeah, certainly. I mean, the show is kind of ever evolving, which is something that was baked into it from the beginning, that there's a certain amount that stays consistent, and then there's a certain amount that we can play with. And so we've been figuring it out as we've been going along, and getting feedback on the show has been great to kind of weigh those decisions and in which directions
we want
to go to.
What's been some good feedback you've gotten that's been constructive?
I haven't. Everyone just tells me it's great. Don't stop doing what you're doing. Never change, Brad. You're awesome. So I'm just running. I'm going to roll with that. But no, I mean, all jokes aside, you always want to try to make it better. You know, I watch it, you know, before it goes out with Matt, and I see things in myself where, I
like
mean,
what?
Maybe,
like, what do you notice?
Like the way I move my face, or the way I talked, or like just certain mannerisms that, you know, watching yourself sometimes, you're just like, maybe I could clean that up a little bit. I could be better.
See, that, I mean, it's interesting because I think we all, you know, we all hate the sound of our own voice and everything. Do you think that's just being overly sensitive, or do you think he actually has a point in what he's observing?
I definitely take into account, like, if Brad doesn't like the way he's being portrayed, especially at this point mm-hmm. when he gets kind of the bigger picture of it or has seen it work, like, I don't want to put something out there that he's not happy with. Him being passionate about the subject and what is happening on camera is, like, I think very important, not just like for me, but I think for the people that are watching. Like, they want to see him have fun and be doing stuff that he cares about. I think in terms of like feedback or the way we've evolved, like, I think clarity is something that from the beginning was kind of the challenge with a show that's so zany. Yeah. So just getting better about explaining topics in a certain way, or not being repetitive in the wrong areas.
Right. And I feel like we're personally just always trying to be a little better with that too. Like, I'm a kind of hyper person, especially when the camera's on, you kind of go sometimes. And I've gotten much more aware over the past couple of years that, like, by slowing things down at certain points or explaining things clearly, sounds silly, but sometimes it's hard to do. And I'm a mumble, I'm a fast talker, and it can get lost when I'm just kind of blowing through things. So, like, finding, working together with the end result to make a finished product video and not just black out and have a good time.
And that happened with the three of us. Like, when Vince was the one shooting, when Vinny was the one shooting, you know, they would go off and shoot, and then I would get a pile of footage and try to make heads and tails of it. And that was a fun challenge with Vince and I to figure out, like, all right, when do you kind of let Brad go off the deep end into like weird territory, and when do we need him to summarize something and get us from point A to point B in like a clear, concise way?
Right.
I think one thing that makes the show so successful, when I think about it, is that while you're having fun on camera, there's no shortage of personality. At the end of the day, you do know what you're talking about. You have done your homework. Yeah, for the most part. Like I said, you're not A++, but you're doing well enough that, like, if you don't know something, you're not afraid to admit that you don't. I don't understand when you have time to learn about all this stuff, do all this stuff. You've got a full-time job. Yeah. You've got two kids. It's like, and yet you actually know how to ferment everything, woodwork, you know, hunt, all that stuff.
Well, I mean, it is a challenge, and it has become harder and harder, and it's actually something that we're trying to figure out now. Fermentation being so fickle and the test kitchen being more and more busy, especially with how much videos that we shoot there, you know, it's not like you're going to make a steak recipe where you know it's going to take an hour and a half. We can buy the ingredients. We can do it. Fermentation, it's so much variation, and it's so, you know, temperamental, and maybe it needs 3 days, maybe it needs 10 days, but whether it's 80 degrees out or 90 degrees out makes a very big difference in timing. So logistically, it's tricky to plan around and shoot around.
At the same time, there's a lot of pros to that too, which is that you can take an episode like tapache or ginger beer or kombucha, which follow essentially the same process, and they're all wildly different episodes because different things happen. So it gives the show a longevity.
The unknown
that like things are going to change and we don't have full control. And that's why this episode that's just bottling this thing is going to be different than this episode that's also the same process.
And that's what's great, because that's what's going to happen to people too.
Right.
Like ginger beer is a perfect example. I developed it. I made it like 5 times and it worked fantastically. When we go to shoot it, I got some real nice fancy young ginger from the farmer's market. And like,
saw that.
And it like didn't want to ferment. It didn't take off the way the stuff I got at Whole Foods or at like the supermarket did. And I'm not quite sure why yet, but that's just, and we just rolled with it. Instead of like doing another shoot, we showcased that. And I had some old bottles of a previous one that were very carbonated, and we talked through it. And like, that's part of, people are going to have that experience.
And I think going back to Garlic Honey is an episode that I think you and Vince and I actually talked about when we were choosing topics. Adam was in the room with us and we were going over what topics, and we looked at Garlic Honey and you asked like what the process for that was. And we're like, well, he puts garlic in some honey and then he comes back later. And that's
it's 45 seconds.
Right.
Episode,
and it was right. Like, how does that, because at the time, like you said, we were doing those overhead videos where it was like fast, 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 fast. Like how quickly can we get the video on, you know, whatever. And we were like, no, trust us. Like, I think it's going to take some time. And it ended up being like a 5.5 minute episode with 2 ingredients and 1 action. And that's been a fun part of it too, is like something that doesn't seem like an episode can turn into an episode by leaning into Brad's antics and personality.
Antics and also the other personalities in the test kitchen,
right.
And the fact that it is an open set.
It's a hive.
Can I should know this as an editor in chief. Is this a cheap show to make?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, it's
all right. Good answer.
As far as production values and as far as money goes, it's probably the cheapest show Condé Nast has ever made.
Because like the test kitchen's already there.
Right.
The ingredients don't cost
other
much.
Than salary.
Other than salary and like $10 for some farmer's market ginger, that's it.
Oh, God,
I mean, and yeah, I mean, we've shot episodes for nothing, and we've done all,
we've kept the crew small too, part of that intentional, because you get a different rapport with Brad when it's just Vince behind the camera, just me behind the camera, as opposed to like 15 people behind the
camera. And then we've had those moments as the YouTube channel has grown. Like sometimes I'll walk in the test kitchen and there's like 11 people behind. I'm like, who are all these? Why are there that many people there? Like, and I think that was so charming about the very first episode. It was basically Brad and Vince.
It's still there, just not Vince.
And oftentimes you don't need much more than that. In terms of production values, sometimes you need lighting,
and you
want the sound to be good enough. And I think we sort of take that for granted that those things are going to be locked in, and those do require people. But it's been, as editors at Condé Nast, as we've seen our video views and revenue, all that stuff grow over the years, like what works and what doesn't. And I mean, I don't know, if you look at a brand like Vogue, and I'm just going to mention them because sometimes they'll early on, I remember, have spent like a ton of money, let's make the most beautiful, amazing videos. And I don't want to say no one watches them, but
it doesn't always pay off.
Yeah, an expensive video does not translate to views.
No, big time. Yeah. We still do it, and we've gotten a little bigger with like some of the going places stuff as far as crew goes.
Like the going places G5, the jet?
Yes.
It was cheap. We have since bought a jet.
Business
and
has been
we travel around the world, guzzling gas.
You got to get to where you got to get to. Sometimes those locations are, you know, there's not like airfields just right there. You know,
we sail everywhere. Yeah. We've grown a little bit, but we still kind of keep that core, and I want to even do it more maybe in the future. Like I kind of miss the adventure of no sound guy, no light guy. It was just me and Vince, and or if we could do a three-piece band, great. If it was like
the Police.
Just like the Police. I'll be Sting.
That's a Sting, yeah.
You'll be Sting.
Oh my God. And you know, it's just, I think that what I love about that is that it keeps it personal, but it also allows us to get in the smaller cracks. You know what I mean? Like, without clamming up the people who we're shooting with. So when you go shoot with someone and all of a sudden you're slating in, there's sound guys, there's a boom of sound, there's a light, they're bouncing in your eyes. People...
I've done shows before in the past where I'm like the host guy, and there's just, I'm like the person who's like asking me the questions and like trying to prompt me. And I'm like, dude, just stop. Like,
it's
and there's
conversation.
A two, you know, I'm like, this is not working.
Yeah. Right? And that's part of what Vince was really good at initially filming, is just letting Brad do his thing and not interfering too much. That's part of what Vince was really good at initially, was not interfering with what Brad was doing. And I get from the logistical sense, it's kind of a stakes issue in a way, in the sense if you have, if you're on location, if you have a bunch of talent and you want a sound person that's going to nail the sound, you want a lighting person that's going to nail the lighting, and there's a lot you've invested in that, you don't want a part of that to be screwed up. Whereas when it's just right. Brad and I filming the kitchen, I'm doing the lighting, doing the sound, doing the filming, the directing and the editing. And, you know, I'm not necessarily going to nail all those jobs 100%, but the trade-off is that you get a very personal rapport between Brad and I,
especially when you go out in the road, like when you're getting people to come on camera with you and share their lives, who are not hosts of videos, who don't be on camera.
It's a comfort level thing for them.
And
too,
then
yeah.
as soon as when it's just Vince or you or whoever, and that all of a sudden that person's gone, and then they're just talking to me. But when there's the big production, it's never gone.
No. Yeah.
And people clam up. I've seen social butterflies, people that were just exploding with energy and personality, action, and they're just.
It's so weird because it sounds cliche, but you never know till you know. Like,
yeah,
who's
exactly.
going to be on with the camera and who's not.
When a camera is turned on in front of you, you act differently. Yeah. And that's also part of the reason that Vince would turn the camera on before Brad was aware of it and just kind of roll into it, because you catch him off guard and you lose that sense of like, all right, oh, we're shooting a movie. Like, okay, action.
And almost got fired 12 times.
So. And also the things that we're shooting in the kitchen, why I think why that works in the kitchen is the things that we're doing are very low stakes in the grand scheme of things, but to Brad, it's very high stakes. So like him spilling kombucha or something on the ground is ultimately low stakes, but Brad's very invested in it. And so
it's a disaster.
It's a disaster, but it's not like we spent $10 million and there's a crew that we hired. And that's, I think, why it works.
There was I was listening to a Kevin Bacon podcast, probably with Bill Simmons. And he was talking about, which director was he talking? Did he ever do a Scorsese movie? Bacon? Was he in one? I forget which director it was with. No, it was with Clint Eastwood. So it was Clint Eastwood. And he said one thing he thought was great about working with Clint was that when it was time to roll, like, you know, Clint's very, like,
yes.
And like, he would never do the with the thing. It was just very like soft. I'm like, all right, start filming.
Don't startle.
Yeah, yeah, but it was not like, we're filming now.
I've heard that
before. We're filming
too.
Now. It was just like, all right, go ahead.
Yeah.
And he said it put everyone on set very sort of at ease and just sort of.
I think that was on the Marc Maron podcast.
That might have been the same story.
Might have been the same story. Because yeah. I heard that same story.
Okay.
Too.
All right. It's a good story, though. But I think you might want to use that.
Yeah.
The soft clap.
We actually did that on Hawaii, where we would slate off to the side and then go up with the cameras to, you know, make sure the cameras are synced, and then go over, rather than doing that in front of everybody, where it's kind of like,
jarring.
All right, everybody quiet down. Yeah. Like, we want to capture what's happening and the relationships that people
have. And I don't
have.
Need everything to be shot with a red camera in slow-mo.
Look at you got like the YouTube
analytics,
the red camera. Steven Spielberg over here.
Talks about f-stops and shutter speeds.
Yeah. G5s. What's the next episode, Brad? That's not yet.
Oh. Coming out. Well, we did a fantastic episode with the Masked Cowboy, Orville Peck. I'm really excited for that to come out.
And what's that on?
We made elote.
Oh, cool. Corn. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then we have, what do we have coming out, Hunsie? We did a little two-parter up with a buddy of mine, Jimmy DiResta. We welded together this outdoor cooking rig.
Oh, yeah.
And then we brought it in the woods and we cooked
on it. That sounds awesome.
We have cured ostrich egg yolk coming up.
Wow.
Like Bataarga, chicken egg, duck egg, ostrich egg, Bataarga.
Lots of good stuff.
Well, we're just getting started.
I just wanted to add, I know we're wrapping up time. Yeah. I just wanted to add one fun fact about the When It's Alive was starting, was I was only supposed to work here for 2 weeks.
Really?
Yes.
That's a good tidbit.
I came in on a 2-week contract through a staffing agency and did the overhead videos, the hands and pans, as we call them. And the Friday that I was supposed to be done on, I was like, that was fun. It was cool to work here. You know, thanks, whatever. And Vince said, all right, see you Monday. And I was like, okay. And so I came
back. Come back, HR. It's like, why does this Hunziker name keep on popping up in our
files? We haven't paid him in months.
And so it was a real weird start process where I never was sure if I was coming back the next week. And working on It's Alive. And that was kind of the reason I was like, I kind of really want to come back and keep working on this project. And when that started to develop, like Vince and I collaborating on that is what solidified me staying here. Because I was supposed to be in and out and see ya.
Well, look at you now, bud.
That's amazing. What all right, before we go, Hunzi,
plug your comedy shows.
Give us a bit. Give us a bit that you've been working on lately that you've liked.
All of my favorite bits are about my grandmother.
Oh, really?
And okay. How just like I'm very grateful to still have her in my life. But she has lived forever and is like over it. Like like she had a long happy life and then she's been around for like 25 more years. Like
that is funny. You can be like 70, you're like, I'm done, and they're like, no.
You just run out of things to do. Like we were at a wedding, and halfway through the reception, she took her hearing aids out and set them on the table, and I was like, Grandma, what are you doing? She goes, I've heard enough for today.
Oh my God.
I got a lot of stories about her.
When's your next gig?
November 8th.
Okay.
QED, 11 p.m. in Astoria.
All right. Do you have like a website or anything?
Yeah, follow me on Instagram. Okay. I'll promote him there.
All right. Follow Matt Hunziker on Instagram. Brad Leone, you're on the, whatever. Yeah, everyone knows. Yeah. Ugh. You're on the YouTube, the Instagram, all those things.
You can find him.
Just not Twitter.
This has been fun. I learned so much.
Oh, this is a blast. We should do it again sometime.
We will.
Because I feel like we are just getting started, man.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Adam.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Okay, guys, new segment here, mailbag segment. Thinking of calling it the feedback.
Cool.
That's good.
Yeah.
Is that good? I didn't know if it was good or terrible.
I just think we should have like a jingle or some kind of like sound effect of like the bag getting opened.
Something holiday-esque.
Yeah.
I like that. Or,
yeah.
Okay, so we get a lot of feedback here at Bon Appetit in various forms. And we love it. I would say most of it is positive, some not so. And we just want to share that in this segment. Ryan, you're probably the one who gets the most actual handwritten letters.
I do. On the typewriter?
Yeah. People still have typewriters.
Yeah. And they also will put Adam's name and the address to the World Trade Center on the envelope in a typewriter.
Yeah.
In addition to the entire typed note.
You also get the like postcards with that certain kind of very flowy script.
Yeah. Beautiful.
Which is like a penmanship era that is far behind us now.
Cursive.
Like they don't teach cursive. Like that's what my grandma's cursive looked like.
So your guys are what? Like 9 and
15 and 10.
10. Marlon's about to be 12. They don't teach cursive in school
anymore,
do they?
My guys learned cursive.
Oh, did they?
But it's just like not that like slanted.
Perfect angle.
Yeah.
Loopy.
Mm-hmm, it was very serious loopy. Business when serious. I was in school.
Yeah.
Cursive.
I will say what's impressive, and we are going to get to the mail, with kids these days, they learn to type when they're like 5 years old because they're all on their devices.
Yeah.
All right, so we do get handwritten letters, oftentimes with pages of the magazine torn out with the point that they want to make. Carla, you're probably the person on staff. You're probably the most active person on Twitter still. You probably get a lot of DMs on Twitter and Instagram. I imagine.
I do. I'm kind of like one of the most active Bon Appetit Twitter people now that you've stepped off the platform. Mm. And so I get a lot of things that some are for me, but a lot of them are like, Carla, can you show this to Claire?
You're like,
they're like, hey, Carla, I can't. You're the only one I can find. Please ask Claire what her astrological sign is and her time and date of birth. I'm writing a paper on her. And I'm like, no.
Yeah, I get a lot of DMs on Instagram. And I pretty much always will DM back as long as they're not like really irate and not nice about something, but always happy to correspond. And then, yeah, then we also get a ton of comments on our YouTube platform. And certain times there is a subject that garners lots of comments and lots of thoughts. And this month being Thanksgiving month, Rye, if you could read us a few of the mashed potatoes comments from Carla and Molly's mashed potato recipe.
I'm ready for this.
Number one, potato soup done. Now on to mashed potatoes.
LOL.
You just keep going, Rye.
Carla, Molly, I love you guys so much, but y'all absolutely decimated those potatoes. Gotta agree with everyone here. That's basically soup.
I mean, everyone's entitled to their opinion. We didn't make soup, though.
So, all right. So you guys were in quest of the ultimate, the perfect, making perfect, the perfect mashed potatoes. You ended up more with a puree than mashed potatoes.
So
in your mind, what
thing.
Was the
We debated so much about how to go about the perfect mashed potatoes. And a lot of our conversation was about, you know, creamy versus crunchy in the world of potatoes. But once we got into mashed potatoes, I have to admit, we didn't like have a debate about, do you like mashed potatoes where if you stick a spoon in them, the spoon will stick straight up, which is a comment that someone said, like, mashed potatoes, that's the ideal texture. Like, we didn't debate that because that is not correct.
Well, Rye, what kind of mashed potatoes did you grow up with?
I think the spoon stuck out a little bit.
Yeah.
In the texture. Most of it was always like, it could be held by a spoon.
So it has been revealing to me in that I now know that some people's ideal mashed potato texture is basically like chicken salad, which I didn't know before we made this episode.
Okay, but you also
people want to take like a scoop and then scoop it.
All right, in their defense, that was certainly in the mashed potatoes I grew up with in my household. You worked in fancy restaurants back in the day. I think what you and Molly made, which had with this amazing crispity, crunchity topping, I would call it probably more like pureed potatoes.
It's a pomme puree, 100%.
In that Robuchon sort of way.
Very much that it is not, it is meant to move on the plate a little bit, but it could take a back of the spoon depression and it would hold gravy.
Like, well, it says in your defense.
Yeah.
If it was potato soup, like everyone says in the comments, why doesn't it run off the spoon when she lifted it up?
Exactly. I did that little fork test in the vid where I like lifted it up and it kind of comes down to a peak, but it doesn't pour through the tines.
Let me ask you this. If you had called the recipe perfect pureed potatoes, do you think there would have been an uproar?
Yes, by the people who do the titling on YouTube.
Meaning what?
They would have been like, it has to say mashed potatoes.
Oh, that's like the SEO hit and everything?
Exactly.
Yes. Oh. So I think where you, Carla, if I may.
Yes.
And I'm going to jump in here with a comment, Rye. Where you got yourself perhaps in the most trouble was when you were responding to all this pile on by negative commenters. Then you were venting at work. And then Alex Beggs, one of our writers in her newsletter, quoted you, I would say, off the record, because you were people, but YouTube commenters can't taste through the screen. Like, oh, potato soup. Everybody shut up, said Carla, shaking her head. Tell me how to do it in Ireland is besides the point. Exasperation. Everyone is wrong. Exclamation point. More scrolling until she lifts her head up and tells me there will be no apology video. Stay strong, Carla. So then I got a DM from an angry follower. Can I just ask how the FBA is taking a stance against their own followers? You actually allowed someone to put in print, Carla is telling everyone to shut up, yada, yada, yada. I defended you in the sense like, well, you shouldn't meet Carla live music. No. But I was like, you were quoted off the record. Like,
there's a difference between feedback, like the nice typed letters that Ryan gets and comments, mm-hmm. which people just sort of fill the void of YouTube to sort of give very off the cuff anonymous. There's no return address. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's also instantaneous.
And I think people like to, you know, for every complaint letter, 10 people were happy or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was a little, I felt a little defensive when I started seeing those comments. I think because I didn't know that there were negative comments. And I got a text from Molly who was like, oh my God, people are all freaking over us out in the comments. And I was like, What do you mean? Like, so proud of our recipe. And then I started reading through them. And I, in fairness, I knew that Beggs was probably transcribing every word I said. But, you know, I guess I just don't agree.
And that's fine.
That's totally fine.
And I think people say that's not how it should be. It should be the way my mother made it is like not useful to me.
Well, they can make it the way their mother made
exactly
it. There you go.
They can get their mom's recipe. And I would just say one last thing before we move on. The next controversial subject, it's not that we don't want people to disagree. It's just being on the receiving end on social media of people piling on who are just shouting you down and telling you you're an idiot or they hate you.
Right.
Not a lot of fun. It's yeah. like, I'm fine to have a discussion that you think potatoes should be this way versus that way, but yes. like, those potatoes suck. You're
and
like,
there were
okay.
people who did say, oh, I love the video. It was fun to see their process. I like a stiffer mash.
Yeah,
like,
cool.
Point taken.
Totally.
You know, but then just sort of describing it. I think also there's one clip in the video where we're pouring the potato from one pot into the serving dish and it does like fold back on itself in a ribbony kind of a way. And I don't think people are used to that texture.
No.
But I also don't think people should yuck other people's yums. So
well, have you not been on the internet in the last
yes,
10 years?
I know. I just firmly stand by my point.
I'm going to say this. I love my mom's mashed potatoes.
Yeah.
But I really love pureed potatoes.
Yes.
There's room for both.
Thank you.
As long as you know what you're doing. All right, on to the next subject. Carly, you kind of got yourself in trouble again. Rye, you want to hit us with this DM?
Yes. Regarding the November issue, I cannot believe my eyes when I saw you recommending using MSG in gravy. While the naturally occurring MSG is less harmful, the chemically engineered MSG causes horrible symptoms in people that are allergic to it. I'm one of those people, and I resent your comment that the FDA says it is harmless. It is not. There are many other ways to achieve that umami to the max that you describe. You tried this a few years ago, and I wrote you with no response, but I did see that many people also wrote you, as it was noted in the next issue. Shame on you for misleading people. I subscribed too many years to count, and things like this are very disappointing.
There are a lot of recipes that we run that have known allergens in them. And obviously, if you're allergic to an ingredient, then you would not use that ingredient. And that might be the dairy in the mashed potatoes, or it might be the nuts in the radicchio salad. I will say, however, that the idea that MSG causes these widespread symptoms in huge swaths of the world population is not true.
And so
I stand by that.
So talk to us about MSG. Like you and I, same ballpark age wise.
Yeah.
We grew up like, oh, MSG is terrible for you, and like you shouldn't eat this food and take out this and that and
yeah.
blah blah blah.
And that basically that point of view has basically been argued to be just a cultural racism mm-hmm. against an ingredient that is used throughout all of Asia. You know what I mean? And so I think that for me, learning about MSG is what changed my mind about using it as an ingredient. So I read a bunch of articles about it. I read scientific things about it. I read Harold McGee's articles about it. I, you know, kind of took steps to learn more. And as I did, I realized that what MSG does as an ingredient is it replicates a natural occurring reaction on your palate, which is the ability to sort of taste umami, right? So it activates the glutamate receptors that like mushrooms or parm or seaweed or a bag of Doritos is going to do. And once I realized that, like, you know, it some people are allergic to it, just like some people are allergic to peanut butter. If you're not allergic to it, though, it is an amazing flavor enhancer. Mm-hmm. And if you can't use it, I've had some comments from, I've had some DMs from people too who are like, I really do react to MSG. Is there something else I can use? Someone DM'd me and she was like, my mom is really sensitive to MSG. And I recommended to her to like use some mushroom powder or try using soy sauce. Like those are also things that will have a similar effect.
You called for it in your book.
Where
Cooking Begins, available now at major booksellers.
My one like really negative review on Amazon is someone who's like, where Cooking Begins, I'll tell you where it ends. It ends when you put MSG on your chicken wings. And it's like, no, I get it. Like if you don't like MSG, then don't use it.
Yes, don't use fish also if you can't.
But I also have MSG on my melon salad in my book, and I think that it makes things taste really good. And that's
okay.
That's okay, and I think that that perspective is shared by, you know, entire continents.
Yeah, but I think it helps. I mean, it helps just talking about the taste buds and whatnot. It helps to, I think a lot of us are not educated on the complexities of MSG and what it is and how it works. And so it's helpful to hear this.
Yeah, and I think I grew up in the 80s when it was like, you would scream no MSG.
Yeah.
So I wrote an article about an MSG, which is on BA.com, and I think it's called Give MSG a Chance. And I talked about this and I linked to a couple of other articles that really helped change my mind about it. So check it out.
All right. Entry in the feedback, Rye. You got a bunch of torn out pages from the October Best New Restaurants issue. As the editor-in-chief, one of the last things we do before we ship the magazine is we have to choose what's on the TOC, table of content pages, because often they're photos that we love but did not make their way into the rest of the magazine.
It's also sometimes, I feel like the TOC is like the cover, it's like what we wish the cover could be.
So at this month, I was like, okay, we're going to put a picture of a baby in a giant stock pot. Taped on the giant stock pot is the words lunch special with the baby looking at the camera longingly.
Can we add that this is like one of the cutest babies ever photographed?
And whose baby it is.
Right.
Yeah. So it's the baby of the owners of Ochre, which was our number four best new restaurant in America. It's a bakery in Detroit. Some of the readers
willingly put their baby.
Yes,
pot.
Yes. Some of the readers did not feel as strongly in that as we did about this photo. Brian, what kind of feedback?
So,
did we get?
Just minding my own business, opening mail. I received five letters, and with some of those letters, people ripped out that page with the baby. And one of them, actually, someone wrote on top of the pot, "How sick is this ad? I'd like answers."
What? Oh, it's not an ad, but it's a table guidance. What did the actual letters say? What did some of these say?
Yeah, so Mr. Rappaport, in my 73 years, I've never written the editor of a magazine. However, this page with an adorable toddler in a cooking pot is so offensive, so totally outrageous, misguided, and stupid that I must express my disgust. I must let you know how offensive I find this photo. How it is possible that a major magazine would allow a photo with an infant in a cooking pot to appear in print is beyond comprehension. And yes, I fully understand that there is no intent to actually cook a baby or place a baby inside a pot in order to babysit. The photo is really in the worst possible taste, and printing it can only be considered just plain stupid. Really, really, really stupid. If Bon Appetit decided to print something funny or tongue-in-cheek humorous, you failed miserably.
So
it is nice that they said it's a major magazine.
Yeah. No, I think that was a I will say this. Like when I love this photo. And this is baby Yuka, who is Yuka came to our kickoff party before the Hot 10 weekend with the chefs, and one of the cutest babies you'll ever see, and she was also the most chill baby. Mm-hmm. She had these meditative eyes who just look at you in a big crowded party. Unbelievable.
I squeezed those thighs.
I was
a
holding
lot.
Her while they were chowing down smash burgers.
But I don't know. It was one of those things we were looking at on the wall, and I was like, can we run this? Should we run this? And I don't know. There's sometimes it's like 5 p.m. and you know my attention span of 5 p.m. And at some point you're just like, WTF, let's go for it. I don't know, Carla, what do you think?
Well, I guess I want to ask you in all of the reaction that you got to this image, which didn't come up when a bunch of people who have children also were standing and looking at the image as a, designed but not yet gone to print.
Lots
like
of parents
now
in the
that
room.
You've seen all the feedback, does it make you think about it differently? Like when I got all that feedback about mashed potatoes, I was like, okay, I get it. Some people like really stiff potatoes, didn't know that. Mm. I will now have that, you know, in mind. But so looking at it now, do you feel the offense?
If we can have like parent moment, I have a soon to be 12-year-old boy who is driving me insane these days. Mm-hmm. So an adorable baby is so unrelatable to me. I'm just like, oh my God, that baby's so cute. I love you, Marlon, but still. So no, as a parent, there was not a lot of like visceral connection to this image other than like I've never seen a baby in a pot. It's adorable. It's funny.
You know, in fairness to us, I guess, it's not like there's anything else in the pot with the baby.
True. There's no water.
There's no like,
there's no mirepoix.
Chicken stock.
Yeah.
So it's just people's like, imagination.
It's on a counter, not on a...
Yeah, it's not on a flame.
I guess what people... Are people afraid that the baby's going to shimmy around and the pot's going to get knocked off? Is it more of the...
I think the lunch special is what did it.
Ah.
Taping that on there. As if the baby's for lunch.
Mm.
Anyways.
I would eat that baby for lunch.
That was controversial.
Yeah. Can we cut that, Emma? No. Anyways, guys, thank you for joining in our first feedback segment.
Thanks for the feedback.
Cheers.
Hi, I'm Alex Beggs. Welcome to the first installment of Cook, Marry, Kill, which is not literal. I am not a murderer. Cook. I just cooked the soy braised brisket from Allison Roman's best-selling new cookbook, Nothing Fancy, which was featured on this very podcast recently. I needed something dramatic to eat after spectating the marathon, a grueling sport. In the book, the brisket is sliced in a tidy, beautiful fan formation. A perfect half of garlic is on the platter, a glowing red bowl of chili oil, and a three-pronged fork. Mine was a shredded mess, but it was delicious. Sweet from caramelized honey, umami to the max from all the soy sauce and a little fish sauce, savory. You get these warm undertones from cinnamon and star anise. I made quick pickled red onions and cucumbers to go with my shredded meat pile, then made sandwiches on squishy Martin's potato buns and coated those with mayo, scallion, and basil. Today I had the leftovers for lunch in a bowl with roasted squash. It was incredible. Mary. I want to marry this huge holiday bucket of Bjornkorn popcorn that was just announced on Instagram. You know the kind, with three sections of different popcorn flavors and a tin so big you can use it as a snare drum after. But instead of dried out packing peanut tasting popcorn, it's Bjornkorn, the solar popped, nutritional yeast dusted hippie popcorn that the Bon Appetit staff inhales. We are monsters around Bjornkorn. Imagine how badly we'd behave around a bucket of it. Two of the flavors are the original and the cloudy flavor, which is the salty one that makes me cough whenever I eat it. But one is a mystery flavor. What could it be? Pumpkin spice? Gingerbread? I guess I'll find out on our wedding night. Kill. I want to kill the word Plantsgiving. I got a press release today from an online culinary school about planning the ultimate plant-based Thanksgiving with stuff like raw carrot, spice cake. Which I'm 100% fine with in theory. I think people should be able to do whatever they want with plants in the privacy of their homes. The neologism Plantsgiving, though, is too far. Thanksgiving makes sense because you're giving thanks, but unless you're swapping succulents on Plantsgiving, it doesn't follow any logic. Thanksgiving isn't like Watergate, where you can replace water with whatever scandal you're dealing with, like Bridgegate or Puppygate. Thanksgiving is sacred, and anyway, you can invite your friends and your plants without needing to rebrand the whole holiday. We don't need Friendsgiving or Plantsgiving or Daryl'sgiving or whatever comes next. So rest in peace, Plantsgiving.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced and edited by Emma Wertzman, with additional programming help from Carrie Polis and Elise Inamide. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wertzman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to reach out to us about this episode or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness, really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.